today, Australia must get serious before it's too late. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Well, notice post covering finance and property news. I'm joined today by Robbie Barwick from the Australian Citizens Party. Hi, Robbie.
Hi, Martin.
Nice to get you back on again. But boy, we are in serious times. And the question is, have we got serious people in charge?
That sums it up perfectly. So today, the shock is what's happened overnight with the world's largest gas field that is shared between Qatar and Iran. And, you know, the biased Western media is talking about Iran bombing the Qataris, but of course Iran was retaliating for the fact that Israel bombed their part of the gas field because Israel's determined to escalate this. Donald Trump puts out an angry post deflecting blame onto Israel as if he didn't know. Well, then he doesn't deserve to occupy that office because and the relationship with Israel should be scrapped straight away. If any of that is true, that's just crazy. But and when I think about this, Martin, I get so incensed because this is the arrangement that our country is so subservient to that we are going along with all this and cheering it in. And what I think we need to talk about tonight is what a sovereign country would do if Australia was a sovereign country, because it should be, to survive in this crisis. And that means getting serious. As you said, we've got to throw out the old way of thinking. We've got to look at this as our very survival is at stake. And what would you do under those circumstances? And what we're getting from the government and from the other power, the Reserve Bank, ain't it. It's got to go.
Yeah, well, of course, we have now a fuel czar, so that's magically going to fix the problem. Well, of course, it won't. It will just create more bureaucracy. And of course, this week we had the RBA coming out and saying, oh, I've only got one tool, so I got to put interest rates up. You know, thinking, well, hang on a moment. How is putting interest rates up going to help anybody in the current environment? And again, short-sighted approaches. And the more I sort of think about this, and yeah, we can talk about the neoliberal philosophy of let the markets rip. Well, look what happens when you let the markets rip. You know, oil prices go through a lot of speculation, of course, around the oil price at the moment. But I just want to touch on the critical issue. You know, was it Israel or was it Trump who actually made the first move in the first place? And I think there's a big question around that. You know, was Trump almost forced into this? You know, Trump, the guy who said, look, I'm only interested in, you know, a local focus on what's great for America. America I'm not first. Going to engage into international conflicts. And here he is creating the mother of all international conflicts without any clear justification or clear sense of what the end point might be. And I also want to make the point that there were a number of significant experts, military and also civil, who said beforehand, look, if you go into the Iran story, it's all going to be about oil and gas, and you know, they are there to protect the regime at all costs. And I know Iran is not a great country, and there's a lot of issues, but they were in negotiations. They were still negotiating when in fact Israel hit. So look, there's big international questions, but I do want to focus in on Australia. Australians are now facing down the barrel of a really very bad situation. And the question is, can we learn the lessons? We didn't learn them through COVID. We actually went back to business as normal, right? Almost immediately afterwards, despite what happened there. So can we learn the lessons this time? And have we missed the boat? Is it too late? Have we effectively given away our future?
Well, let's talk about that. Now, because of the shortage of time, I don't want to get distracted by what you said. I'm just going to give you a ringing endorsement of what you've said on the Iran conflict. But I want to begin what I say about in answer to your question is Australia has to break with the past on a number of levels, including starting with our foreign policy, because we could be leading the countries that normally are submissive to the Americans We're the Australians. We've fought alongside America in every war for a century. We could be the ones saying, no, this ends now. We're not with you. And then let the American administration explain that to the American people. They get to use us like a bit of a mascot, you know, like we're Crocodile Dundee or something, right? The good old Aussies are always with us and we're so lovable. Let's actually change that. And this is why I'm holding Anthony Albanese responsible. I believe in judging people by their own standards. You know, it can be, you can get, a, you can, if you judge them by other standards, you might get a bit in trouble, but judge them by their own standards. And the two people I think most deserve to be judged in the world right now by their own standards is Donald Trump, because the person who would be attacking him the most, right? Because everyone's afraid to attack him. But the one person who wouldn't be afraid to attack him is Donald Trump from 2020, 2016, 2015, 2014, 2013, 2012. Go listen to the videos of that guy talking about these wars, right? And realize that this person in power now is doing the very opposite of what that guy said, but that's what made him interesting at the time. It's why people paid attention to him, and it's why he was hated by the warmongers, by the neocons, who are now his greatest fans. People like the lady from South Carolina, Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, right? These are his fans now. They despised him 10 years ago, absolutely despised him. He is doing their bidding right now. And he deserves maximum condemnation for that. And frankly, second is Anthony Albanese deserves to be judged by his own standards. This is a guy now you could say Anthony Albanese likes using this term, the parties of government, and he expects the both parties of government. This is his cover for the Uni Party. He expects both of them to be responsible. He used to attack the Greens for not being responsible parties of government. Oh, really, Albo? Well, when you were in opposition back in 2003, you, the member for Greenland, Anthony Albanese, led the opposition to the Iraq war. You denounced the American agenda for war in no uncertain terms. And therefore, by your standards, you are a fraud and a coward who is putting Australian lives in danger because you're not standing up to your own standards from 20 years ago. And you have attached us to this war. You've made us complicit in this war. And I got really furious today because he gave this press conference about the fuel czar, but the most of it was a justification. Like, he just lied. It was fraud what he said, because he criticized the Iranians for attacking these dozen countries around it that he said was they're not participants in the conflict. And the reason he said it, Martin, is because he wants to claim that we're not participants in the conflict either. That's his claim, that we're not participants in the conflict. That is a lie. He doesn't get to decide that. It's the Iranians who will decide that. We were participants as soon as it happened because of Pine Gap. Automatically, Pine Gap's involved in the targeting of bombings like the Americans did. So that was an automatic participation. Then we had Australian soldiers on the submarine that sank an Iranian ship unprovoked, and Elbow claimed they were in their bunks. Rubbish. There's no spare room on a submarine. They were in whip, and it doesn't matter what he claims, what the Iranians think. And the third, he's sent over this wedge-tail AWAC, right, which is quite a sophisticated aircraft, and that is providing data that the Americans are using in their command center, right? We are participants, and if we get hit, somehow, if there's a retaliation by the Iranians against us, right, he wants to claim that he's not responsible for it. I'm calling it out now. No, he is responsible for it. And so before anything else in this particular conflict, unless we have a change in foreign policy and demand that a guy go back to the standards that he once espoused, we are in danger. Australia has been put in danger because of this conflict and because of our relationship with the United States and because we're participating in it, whatever he wants to claim, right? That's the big one. And then the other one is what we need to focus on, the economics, because we fluffed it in code. I challenge people, if you've got all the time in the world, scroll back through Walk the World. It's probably the most densely populated YouTube channel on the internet. So you'd have to have a lot of time, but you will find videos in 2020 of Martin and me talking about the crisis facing Australia and what we need to do about it, right? And there was a big consensus that Australia had made itself vulnerable to this breakdown in supply chains that came with COVID, and the lockdowns, because we had basically exported all of our capacity, all of our industrial capacity. We didn't have any, right? And so Josh Frydenberg was the treasurer. He was acknowledging it. Bill Shorten went on the front foot to say, we need to do something about this, right? Now's the time to do something about this. They were prepared to put their neoliberal ideology aside and say, what do we do? And I'm guessing, Martin, it lasted, what, 6 months, 8 months, something like that, right? It was pathetic. The Citizens Party, as you remember, we went on the front foot and we put up a proposal that the government had a lending mechanism called the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. And it was the only one we saw that they had, right? And we said, okay, that is essentially a mini, it's a $10 billion government investment bank that's dedicated for clean energy. It can still do clean energy. Scale it up. Scale it up big time. Make it a big investment bank. Let's start investing in our own capacity, right? That's what we called for at the time. We went on a big campaign. We even drafted a bill at the time that Bob Katter wanted to introduce into Parliament. But as soon as we put it to the drafting office, who referred it to the clerk's office, big fat no, flat no. Bob Katter had introduced a number of bills for the Citizens Party leading up to that. Never had been a problem, but this one was a flat no. And it's like, oh, there's something about banking they don't want the people to have anymore, right? Now, and then, of course, as soon as they could, they just turned their back on that and went back to. I remember the day I knew we'd gone back to business as usual was the day that Josh Frydenberg came out and said, Australia should stick to areas of its competitive advantage. That's neoliberal jargon for, don't be self-sufficient in any way. Be reliant on supply chains. You just be like this one kind of monoculture economy. Focus on, well, in our case, what's our competitive advantage? Raw materials, right? Not processing raw materials, just digging them up out of the ground, being a quarry. That's our competitive advantage. And when I heard that, however many months into COVID, I thought, I knew, okay, it's over. These guys have flipped back to their neoliberalism. We're doomed. Of course, no one feels you're doomed because, there's a sense, oh, well, we survived that, just or whatever, but we survived that. But I think what we're dealing with now, more than on paper, you can look at the situation and you realize this can get really bad. But then you look at, well, okay, you balance that with what is the possibility of addressing it? What can be brought to bear to stop the war so things can return to some kind of normalcy so that 20% of the world's oil supply can once again resume flowing, right? Which is now rather complicated by these destruction of these gas facilities, because that's going to take years to repair just there, right? I think the field that has been bombed is like 80% of the world's known reserves. It's quite extraordinary. Qatar was responsible for something like 40%. I might have some of these figures wrong, but it's in that order at least 40% of the world's urea. Based on the gas from Qatar, right, used as a feedstock. So that's like, whoa, this is going to have long-term consequences, more than just on paper. And therefore, unlike COVID, which was we put restrictions on ourselves, each country put restrictions on itself to deal with a virus, right? And they chose to be, some chose to be more restricted, some chose to be less restrictive, but it was a choice. This is a different thing. This is a breakdown. That's been called. The choice was the war, and now we've got a breakdown. And I don't think there's any walking away from this. And so the question that we have to get to the bottom of, do we have leadership in Australia that's capable of turning their back on everything that they've been ideologically brainwashed into and leading us into survival based on major economic changes?
And I've always had the view that the neoliberal philosophy is a neoliberal virus, right? It is actually harmful, and it gets spread. All of that sort of metaphor that you can use. But of course, the other observation is that we've got this massive spend going on with AUKUS, which of course is directly coupled with the US big nuclear-powered subs that may or may not appear, turning Australia into an ever stronger military target potentially. But also, what we saw and what we are seeing in the Middle East is that the military game has changed completely. It's not now about a few big subs. It's about a completely different mode of warfare. So we're actually investing on the wrong thing, right, with the wrong partner in the wrong time horizons, which is critical. And it's a huge, huge impost on the budget. But if we'd actually invested in local, for example, refining capacity rather than turning them down, and actually invested in exploiting some of the oil reserves that still exist in and around the Australian mainland, we would be in a very different position. So, you know, you can see policy decision after policy decision going in the wrong direction. And the banking system, and the way the banking system is locked into this neoliberal philosophical view, is a big part of the problem, because essentially nobody wants to touch it. Nobody wants to actually, you know, really lay bare what some of the root causes are, why we've ended up in this. Well, I think it's a cul-de-sac, and it's a cul-de-sac with no way out unless we fundamentally change our way of thinking. Now, the crisis that we have will probably get worse before it gets better. And of course, they're talking about things like, well, maybe having to ration fuel and those sorts of things. But you've got to overlay this in this broader context. We have given away the farm, literally and metaphorically.
Yep. Well, I want to talk about Matt Canavan, because I think there's an interesting potential here now that he's the leader of the National Party. But I'll come back to that. And that's going to be an important part of the discussion. But before, just to your point, we recorded our Citizens Report show for the Citizens Party today, and we talked about the Chinese saying the best time to plant a tree is 30 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today, right? Now, so the solution to everything should have been done 30 years ago, or more to the point, we shouldn't have let it be shut down 30 years ago. Right. But I want to talk about a specific thing that happened 50 years ago that would have been even better for us today. And that was 50 years ago, 1976, the Malcolm Fraser government, the Liberal government, shut down one of the best things Whitlam did, which was the Petroleum and Minerals Authority. Gough Whitlam got elected in 1972. And this was like the centerpiece of his program. He and Rex Connor legislated the Petroleum and Minerals Authority. And this was a public authority that had a couple of objectives. One was to encourage Australian ownership of resources, not to buy out existing foreign-owned resources, but for new projects, encourage them to be Australian-owned. Not government-owned necessarily, but Australian-owned, right? And so it had that objective. But its other objective was going to be basically a private oil company / mining company. Sorry, not private, public, a public one, a government-owned one that could actually be a competitor to these private companies, and especially in the area of oil, right, to make sure that Australia had, you know, maintained its own energy independence. Very, very important, especially, you know, Whitlam got elected in December 72. When he was legislating this, the Yom Kippur War was on. Right, and that was with the first oil shock, etc. So they were highly motivated to do this, and they did it. They set it up, but when they set it up, all hell broke loose internationally. They needed, they couldn't get any the usual London or American banks that used to lend money to Australia would not lend for what they wanted to use the Petroleum and Minerals Authority for. They went on a credit strike against Australia, right? And, of course, that led them to go to other sources, which ultimately led to the loan scheme scandal. And but it's because of what it was. It was a threat to the Anglo-American minerals cartel, right? Who, no, you're not going to have any. We decide what happens with the world's wealth, right? No government is going to step in and intervene to direct it for the good of the people. But if we still had that today, Martin, we would have a capacity. It doesn't even have to be the biggest player in the field. but it would be a capacity now that we could be deploying it already to untap. You know, you have when they have oil fields, it's not like they pump them all completely dry. There's nothing there. It just gets a bit, you know, law of diminishing returns, right? So it just gets more expensive and they're drying out. So it gets more expensive to extract. So I understand there's about the, you know, Bass Strait, which was incredibly productive for a long time. That's not being used anymore. It's kind of dried up. It just means it's more expensive. There's about 10% of the oil there, right? Well, we're about to lose all our access to the world's oil. Get funding to whatever you need to get funding to open it up again. If we had our own Petroleum and Minerals Authority, you could be doing that. I understand. I think it's in South Australia. Maybe there's other places, but in South Australia, you've got shale oil and apparently a lot of it. Again, it may be more expensive, but it's not right now. Expense is not the issue. It's supply is the issue, right? And if we lose our supply, we're in trouble. Now, already, I think we get something like 40% of our jet fuel from China. So China refines the 40% of our jet fuel. Now, we have refined some jet fuel itself. China is putting export restrictions on these things, not because it hates Australia, not at all. It's not an aggressive sign against us, but they have to put their needs first. After all, if unless you've got your head buried in the sand, China's not an idiot. Our ally, America, when they justify what they've done to Iran, they will openly say, oh, this is part of our strategy against China. They think they have the right to go around the world and starve whoever they want, cut off supplies, do whatever they want, right? China, like, this is just insane. So China's realizing, okay, we are a secondary target of this, or these lunatics in Washington, so we've got to shore up our supplies. And that means they might not keep exporting that jet fuel to Australia, right? This is the sort of thing we're faced with. If you're listening to the farmers at the moment in this country, it is the what's really freaking them out is the availability of diesel and urea, fertilizer, right? The availability of it. We're in the start of autumn. In the next 5 or 6 weeks is when planting season will begin in large parts of Australia. There's a big question over what level of planting will happen this year in Australia. The farmers are warning we're either not planting or we're going to be planting far less, right? I saw one guy from Western Australia from the Pastoralists and Graziers Association. He tried to assure the viewers. He said, Australia will be okay. We'll produce enough food for Australia, but we produce enough food for 50 million more people than Australia, right? And it doesn't look like we're going to be doing that. Well, I hope he's right that we'll be okay, you know, but these are the things that are at stake. And so what if we had our own Petroleum and Minerals Authority that could be stepping into the breach right now? Or let's cut through the crap. If we still had it, we wouldn't be in this position at all. One thing that started the rot in this area, Martin, this is neoliberalism writ large. I remember when I did the research on this, I couldn't believe what I was learning. Something John Howard did in 1979 when he was the Treasurer under Malcolm Fraser. In those days, Australia was fully self-sufficient in oil, fully self-sufficient. And the Australian price, what Australians paid for oil was based on the local market price, not the international market price, right? So based on the cost of extraction, and what they could sell for the market, that's what we paid for oil. We paid less than most of the world for our own oil, and we were self-sufficient in it. Without changing that, while still keeping us self-sufficient in oil, John Howard introduced a policy to set the local market price at the world price based on this neoliberal idea that only if we had oil here at the world price would it be used at its most efficient. And of course, what it did was it jacked up the price of oil, jacked up the price of fuel. Companies like Esso, which is Exxon, right? The Rockefellers, right? They were the big players. They pocketed the difference. Right, great for them, all for a purely ideological economic policy. Nothing to do with practicalities at all, just because they had this economic ideology. It's like, oh, this is an economic rule we're going to introduce on Australians. And so that was the beginning of the neoliberal wave that just went through and smashed everything through privatization and deregulation and outsourcing for the next 20 years. that's put us in this mess we're in. But there's an example of the kind of insane thinking that we had that's led us to this point, right? So,
and just to say,
yeah,
Robbie, gas is another example of exactly the same thing, right?
Yes.
How is it that Australians are paying international gas prices, which means electricity is horribly expensive, which means energy is horribly expensive, which means manufacturing can't actually make any money, which means they've closed down. It all follows from this idea that somehow we've got to be at that global market price and we've got to let the global market regulate and determine what we pay for everything. That is a fundamentally flawed philosophical point of view driven directly from this massive neoliberal virus.
Yes, and it's an example where the ideology is a cover for the crooks. It's just pure stealing. It is theft. It is theft on the greatest possible scale, coming out of the pockets of the Australian people, and the lunatics that allow it to happen justify it with an ideology. The ideology is crap. Neoliberal ideology has always been crap. You have, if you want to throw it all out, you have an economy, you have a government that sets the rules, and its job is to set the rules to make sure the economy works fairly for people. That's it, right? And they said, no, any role of government is illegitimate, right? Throw it all out. Let this market thing determine, of course, what the market is the law of the jungle, and the law of the jungle is the big eat the little, right? That was always the case, and that's what's put us in the position we're in. But Martin, as you and I have also discussed for a long time, we're in a period, in more interesting period, because we've survived this. We should have a wristband that says "I survived neoliberalism," or maybe we haven't yet. But we'll see. We watched all this happen, right? So 30, 40 years later, you can actually pick it apart, right? You can do an autopsy and say, okay, this is where we went wrong. And so we've been seeing signs in recent times of a backlash to this. The problem is, it hasn't taken government policy yet, right? But there is a backlash to it. And some of those signs are in the forms of some interesting politicians. And one of them is our friend, Jared Rennick, right? Who was a liberal who burst onto the scene in the Senate. And I bonded with Jared because he's the big champion in parliament of our policy from outside of parliament, which is a public bank, right? An infrastructure bank, a national bank. Let's get out there and change the banking system. Now, the government does understand a little bit of this because, someone had prevailed upon Labor to set up the Clean Energy Finance Corporation, just a little baby step, a $10 billion thing. And these are baby steps, right? $10 billion is tiny, but anyway, Clean Energy Finance Corporation, $10 billion thing there. And then when they got to power, there was another thing that was already in the works that Senator Matt Canavan had been instrumental in setting up, called the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility. And that is also essentially a government development bank. Matt did most of the work. Labor finished it off. So that facility exists. That's a $7 billion facility. I want to tell you some more about that in a minute. And then, of course, the big ticket item that Albanese set up was the National Reconstruction Fund, it's called, which is essentially the basis of another development bank, which is a $15 billion facility. So you got $15 billion facility there. You got $10 billion for the Clean Energy Finance Corporation. That's 25. And you got $7 billion for the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility. That's $32 billion. Well, that's $32 billion. That's total. That's the money that's there available for them to use. But Martin, that's about half or less than half of what Australia's banks lend just on housing in a quarter. Right. So the private banking system is geared to pour out much greater amounts of money than that into things like the housing bubble to keep driving up inflation and make housing more expensive. Right. The government's, trepidatious approach to getting back involved in banking is $32 billion in total across three facilities. But anyway, baby steps. At least they've gone in that direction. Now, it turns out, this is what I wanted to say about the Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility Matt Canavan set up. It's actually doing something very useful right now. In 2022, Australia stopped producing urea, which is, like the most important fertilizer, right? It's for putting nitrogen in the soil. This is the big one that's at risk because of the gas from Qatar is the feedstock for like 40% of the world's urea. It's quite extraordinary. But Martin, which country is the only country that rivals Qatar as an exporter of gas? Us.
I know.
Right? And we stop producing. This is this thing that gas is the feedstock for urea. Our farmers desperately need it. And we stop producing it in 2022. But anyway, so there's a company in Karratha in Western Australia called Perdaman, which is actually an Indian sort of multinational that has an Australian operation. They are building a urea plant in Karratha. And guess what? The Northern Australia Infrastructure Facility has loaned them the money to do it and has also lent for local infrastructure to help with the plant. That's actually how it's supposed to work. That plant, that urea plant, will produce something like 2.3 million tons of urea. That's about a quarter of Australia's annual consumption, a quarter of it. Now, obviously, when they designed the plant, they weren't anticipating that there'd be a war in the Persian Gulf, right? And the Strait of Hormuz would close. Maybe if they were designing it now, or maybe even now, smart people could get in there and saying, hang on, can we scale this up at all? Right? And can we scale it up and can we speed it up? Here's more money from the Development Bank to do it. That's what you do in an emergency. But you need those tools. And this is where you see the tool of a National Development Bank is so crucial. Well, this was the history of World War II writ large. World War II was an economic miracle in Australia. It was extraordinary. The smartest thing that Ben Chifley did, who was the treasurer, is he delegated the responsibility for production to a guy who knew how to produce. And he turned to Essington Lewis, who was the general manager of BHP, right? In those days, BHP was a steelmaker primarily, not a miner primarily. It was a steelmaker. Right. And he said, Essington Lewis, you are the director of munitions. And that guy had the power. So he put a genius in charge of the job. But what were his tools? Well, his tools included the Commonwealth Bank, because you need to be able to throw money at everything in a situation like this. And where'd the money come from? It came from the Commonwealth Bank, Australia's national bank. The Commonwealth Bank funded the economic transformation in Australia in World War II. And we not only don't we have the capacity for oil production and fertilizer production in Australia nowadays, which we've got to get back, we don't have the tool, the financial tool like the Commonwealth Bank, and we've got to get that back as well. And what's the other point I wanted to make about Matt Canavan? You can have a national bank, Martin, that's multidimensional. And as you know, there's another context in which you and I have talked about Matt Canavan quite a bit in recent years. Matt chaired the Senate inquiry into bank closures in regional Australia. Now, I was the only person to attend every hearing of that inquiry. You were instrumental with Dale Webster in writing the letter that set up the inquiry, got it set up, and of course, Jared Rennick, our mate, was the senator at the time, and he made sure it happened, right? He got the vote up in Parliament. And Matt was the chair of the committee, and he got to chair the inquiry. He did a brilliant job. He started off giving the banks the benefit of the doubt in the first hearing, that they were making legitimate business decisions. His only criticism was their communication. By the end of that inquiry, he was tearing strips off them, because he and the other senators had seen in town after town after town that the banks had been lying when they're claiming that there was no demand for face-to-face services, because these towns were devastated losing their bank. And he was tearing strips off them. And when it came to the report, he included very powerful recommendations that pissed off the banks. And the first recommendation was to make access to banking and cash an essential service. And the second one was to convene an expert panel to look into the feasibility of re-establishing a government bank in Australia, including one based on the postal bank model that we were pushing, right, that the Citizens Party has a policy for. Now, that upset the powers that be when he did that. But one of the things Matt is public about is that he is not ideological. He used to be someone decades earlier who believed that government should not be involved in the economy, right? Leave these things up to the private sector, up to the market. They make more efficient decisions. By the time I first met him and engaging on this question of a postal bank, etc., he was very frank and said, the private sector didn't do it, right? Leaving it up to the private sector is what has kept left us exposed to all this. That's the point of view he came to. And so he has the courage, he had the courage to put in that report, okay, let's look at the possibility of going back to a government bank. And of course, as I said, he already was involved in this, in establishing this small but very useful one that's now helping to give Australia urea production. The problem is it won't be online until next year, right? And so Matt couldn't anticipate that, and the company couldn't anticipate that, but it's an issue. But if we had the tool, the right tool of a government bank, right, there's all kinds of possibilities that the government could just swing into action for, as if it's like surviving in World War II again and saying, okay, do this, do this, do this. Now bring the best minds on the board. What do we do? Okay, here's the money. Here's the facility. Go and do it, right? That's what you need. And so I wanted to mention that, Martin, because I think if for your viewers, you could actually help here to help push this agenda along. And one of the things you can do is push the National Party to follow through on Matt Canavan's own recommendation that the government establish an expert panel. Because the recommendation's there, the government has ignored it. But my complaint is no one has been talking about it except the Citizens Party and me when I come on your show, right? It's not being talked about, but it's there in black and white. Before Matt, the National Party was led by two bankers in David Littleproud and Kevin Hogan. They hated it. David Littleproud once confronted me in Parliament House at the Queen's Cafe. There was just the two of us waiting for coffee. And I'd met him once before briefly, and I said hi and reminded him who I was. And he ripped into me. He was not nice at all. He turned to me and he blasted me. He said, "You're giving the licensed post offices false hope. Nah, mate, there's not going to be another national bank. Nah, mate, times have changed. The economy's changed. Nah, mate." And what I was hearing, Martin, was bullshit from a banker, right? This guy that was there to serve the interests of the private banks. Well, last year when Matt Canavan, when they lost the election, everyone was in shock, and Matt ran for the leadership. He lost, because his party was not prepared to go in that direction. But this time he won, because it's desperate times in the National Party. One Nation is leaving them for dead in the polls. And so they've rolled the dice and they've turned to a guy who has the pedigree that I've just told you about. Now, I'm not trying to say he's great and he's the great white hope. What I'm trying to tell you is there's a potential. He has his own views that he's made clear. He needs the public to get behind the party and demand, hey, follow through on that. You want public support? Follow through on that. Because if we can use a crisis like this to break the back of this neoliberal ideology that's kept us hamstrung, right, and marching us, frog marching us off a cliff to our doom, to actually change this and get these institutions like government development banks and a government bank back, we can turn this around. But if we don't, we are going to go off that cliff. So there's something that people can practically do vis-a-vis the National Party, just to get behind them and say, hey, go and fight for Matt Canavan's recommendation for an expert panel for a public bank.
And it's quite interesting, because it was Darren Chester is now the deputy. Darren was part of that regional inquiry and actually supported that recommendation of the inquiry and the committee look at the National Bank. And on the other hand, find Jane Hume.
Senator for bankers.
Yeah, exactly right. So, you got to say that there's a significant gap, maybe now philosophically, between those two parts of the so-called coalition. But the point is, not to get political about it, there is a critical issue here for the future of Australia. And it's about grabbing back control and grabbing back that decision-making process within the country and investing in the country and looking at the future of Australia through the eyes, not of neoliberalism, let the markets rule and let it rip and we'll just compete marginally. No, there's a alternative story that can be told here. And I think that's the critical message for tonight, that in a way, this current crisis that we're in should actually be highlighting again. No, you cannot continue down the same path that we've been on. We need to find alternative paths. There are alternative route maps there available. And in fact, the National Bank story could be a leading light in taking that into a different direction.
Look, it's the most important one. It's why we harp on about it so much.
Yep.
I would hazard that our party knows more about Australian history, because we put a lot of emphasis on these things. We know more about Australian history than any other party in Australia. We know the history of the Commonwealth Bank backwards and the state banks. You know, watch our show, watch the Citizens Report, look at our magazine, The Australian Alert. We're constantly publishing these things. We can tell you how we were successful in the past, and at every stage, it's because we had institutions that were geared to make sure the economy served the people, starting with national and state banks, right? Because the financial power is the most important. That's why I use this figure. There was about $70 billion lent by the banks for housing in the last quarter of 2025. $70 billion, right? Good on them. But while they've been doing that, what's happened to our refineries? What's happened to our infrastructure, right? What's happened to our capacity as a country to be able to survive under all circumstances, right? It's gone. We've got to get it back. And the private banks aren't going to line up and fund it, right? You got to do what has worked in the past. And this is the power of a national bank. In America, there's one public bank in America, and it's the state of North. It's the Bank of North Dakota in the state of North Dakota. It's been in place since like 1919 or something. North Dakota is the only state that has never gone bankrupt. It's got more banks per capita than any other bank in America, any other state in America, because the state bank supports the operations of all these private banks, these little private banks, which do serve their communities, right? And very productively so. And I wanted to highlight that just so people don't, you know, hit us with something stupid like this is communism or something. But the public have to play a role here, right? And don't get distracted by rubbish. Now, I mentioned One Nation before, but I wanted to talk about Matt Canavan because, you know, I've had a lot to do with One Nation, including on this subject. But now that they're surging in the polls and they're riding high, one thing I notice is that they're conspicuously not talking about it. And in fact, they're taking money from someone in Gina Rinehart, who has spent her whole time as a rags to riches billionaire, which is what she's pretending she is, rubbish. Her money was left to her. But she spent her whole time continuing what her father did before her, which is fund the most extreme neoliberal think tanks in Australia, right? Which is one of the reasons One Nation recently voted against putting more tax on the gas companies, because that's the sort of thing that a big exporter like Gina won't come at. So I don't know where One Nation is on this. Don't expect some kind of political savior. The people have to demand this. And because Matt Canavan, one, has expressed these views, and two, is now in this position of leadership of a major party that he wasn't before, right? If we can get the Nationals to take the lead on this in the form of this bank idea, One Nation will come out probably, I would imagine, and try and copy it. The Greens will too. The Greens support this, but they don't take the lead on it, right? But we're going to be getting to a critical mass, a majority in Parliament. And bear in mind, the Prime Minister himself said in 2023 on the Neil Mitchell podcast that he would never privatise the Commonwealth Bank. You need a government bank to keep the private banks honest. That's what he said, right? So many people support this, but when push comes to shove, they won't stand up to the banks, the private banking cartel, and they get away with that until the very survival of our country is at stake, like it is right now, right? Like it is right now. And so for you, the viewer, who might have had, you know, views on this in the past and had indulged in these ideas, you really don't want government doing things. Well, who's going to do it now? Who's going to save our country now? If we lose our oil supply, if we lose our fertilizer supply, how do we get it? Right? Who's going to do it? Is you know, Woodside going to fix it? Is BP going to fix it? Is BHP? No, none of them are going to. Is National Australia Bank going to fix it? No, right? None of these things are capable of doing it. It's only the government responding to the people. And if the people get behind this, we can use this, Martin, as an opportunity to force fundamental change that is the only thing that will allow our country to survive circumstances like this. And if we can do that, then we might be able to move on to the big foreign policy issues and start being a country that contributes to these sort of things not happening in the first place, rather than what we've contributed to, which is supporting that it happened and then making it worse.
Yeah, and just before we finalise this show, I just want to come back to the RBA, because this week the RBA lifted interest rates, right? And she said in her statement, we've only got one tool now. That is such a problem because, of course, they have many other tools, not least they could actually redirect lending, redirect the banks to do things differently as well. So actually, the Reserve Bank and the way the Reserve Bank is implementing its monetary policy, which is still philosophically neoliberal in its philosophy too, is part of the problem too. So this is such a critical conversation, yeah, because it means that that institution is part of the problem, not part of the solution. How can lifting interest rates make any difference to opening the Straits of Hormuz?
I talked about this on our show today, right? And I tried to reassure the viewer that they're not mad. Because I think that when people experience a week like this and see that the authorities, the powers that be, the priesthood of finance between the Treasurer and the RBA governor, seriously talking about interest rate rises as some kind of legitimate response to an explosion of oil prices caused by a war on the other side of the world, right? Or as the Batuta advocate put it, they had a really funny headline, war three continents away, war three, you know, the response to war three continents away is you have to pay the bank more money. Right? I mean, it's that ridiculous. Yeah, they say it with a straight face. And so people must think, well, oh man, this finance stuff, this central banking stuff, this must be complicated. Oh boy, this must be, you know, quantum mechanics, right? I can't understand quantum mechanics and I don't think I'm going to understand this, because apparently you can have a cat in a box that's not both dead and alive at the same time. And, you know, inflation works the same way. You know, you can just imagine what's in the poor people's heads, right? And my message to them was, no, you're not nuts. They are nuts. They are lunatics and actually worse. This is where ideology gets you. So in a sense, let's hope this becomes a teachable moment, because it doesn't get much clearer than what you just said. How does raising interest rates open the Straits of Hormuz, right? Which is a big chunk of the thing. Now, as you know, because you said it, but we know that the Reserve Bank is lying when Bullock says she only has one tool, because we saved her other tools because Jim Chalmers was going to legislate them away in 2024, and we saved them. We stopped that from happening. The Citizens Party went on a big mobilization, forced it to a Senate inquiry, and suddenly all these ex-RBA governors and even Peter Costello came out and said, no, don't give up those powers. The powers are there to be used. And the way I explain them simply is the Reserve Bank has the power to direct the banks to reduce lending into areas that cause inflation and to increase lending into areas, productive areas that will reduce inflation, right? Pretty simple. They have that power to do that, and they should be using that power, but instead they think they're there to just basically do the bank's dirty laundry, right? That's the attitude of Reserve Banks around the world. And that's how ours works as well. This really is the big issue, because, you know, if we could actually change this culture around the Reserve Bank, Martin, and win this fight, you've already got a national bank right there. It is already owned by the government of Australia. It's the people. It's already owned by the people of Australia. It was spun off from the Commonwealth Bank. The government of the day could just direct that thing to do everything that we're saying should be done. It's right there to do, right? Now, you could have, it might be better to have a specific dedicated government bank / infrastructure bank that focuses on those things, right? And that's fine too. But short of that, in a crisis, the Reserve Bank has the powers to do everything that they need to, and the government has the power to direct it to do that. And if our survival's at stake, right, throw out the people that just keep quoting ideological claptrap and demand it. Because otherwise, you're going to keep getting these insane decisions. That means millions of households are now being crushed more this week than they were last week. They're already being crushed last week, and they're going to be crushed more this week and continue to be crushed. And they'll come up with more excuses to raise interest rates. Meanwhile, the banks are going to get a boost of revenue from it. And you noticed it took, I think it took less than 3 hours, Martin, for all the big four banks to jack up their rates, right?
Yep.
Oh, they were on it straight away. Oil companies are making a killing right now. With what's happened to the gas field in Qatar, its number one rival exporter, Australia, our gas cartel, they're probably rubbing their hands together with glee. They're about to make a mozza. They're going to be going back to the Albanese government saying, no, we don't want you to implement that fuel reservation scheme you said you were going to do at Christmas, because we're going to be making so much money out of gas that we don't want the Australian people to have any of it, right? And if Albanese is pathetic enough to probably allow them to do that, but so they're making a killing, and Australians have got to snap out of it and realize, no, we're not the ones insane here. They've been gaslighting us. This has to end. And if it doesn't end with policy, it's going to end with pitchforks and guillotines. You got, right? Bring down the regime eventually. If they cannot respond to a crisis like this and actually implement solutions that are in our own history and that these very people have espoused in their own past. But we, the people, have to demand that.
Absolutely. And just finally, Dale Webster just posted something which I thought was quite fascinating. She talked about Robin Vale, a place out in the sticks. She made the point that
Outside of Mildura.
yeah, they've run out of fuel there. They closed the branch before that, so leaving the customers to drive 200 kilometers to do their banking. They've now run out of fuel, so that means that they've now got no banking, no bank, no fuel. And the point I want to come back to is that this is
Perfect
not
storm.
just about, philosophical. This is real people in real locations dealing with real issues because of the failure of government, because of the failure of government policy, and we have to change it. And that's what this show has been about. Robbie, thank you so much.
Thanks, Martin.